T.E. Lawrence's name echoes through history with an almost mythical resonance. This Oxford archaeologist turned warrior became one of the 20th century's most enigmatic figures, a man who helped reshape the Middle East while struggling with his own conflicted loyalties. Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson has become a cultural touchstone since its publication, praised by historians and casual readers alike for its nuanced portrayal of Lawrence and the complex web of imperial ambitions that created today's Middle East. The book's enduring popularity stems from its relevance to contemporary geopolitics. Many modern conflicts trace their roots directly to the decisions made by Lawrence and his contemporaries during World War I. As Christopher Hitchens noted, if you want to understand why the Middle East is in the state it's in today, you must read this book. When World War I erupted in 1914, the European powers were wholly unprepared for the industrial slaughter that awaited them. While millions died in the trenches of the Western Front, the Middle Eastern theater remained a sideshow of a sideshow, drawing minimal resources and attention from military planners. This neglect created an extraordinary opportunity for a handful of young, untrained, and largely unsupervised men to shape history through their own initiative, cleverness, and sometimes treachery. At the center of this story stands Thomas Edward Lawrence, a shy 26-year-old Oxford archaeologist with no military training who would transform himself into Lawrence of Arabia. How did this unlikely figure become the battlefield commander of a foreign revolutionary army and a political master strategist? The answer lies in the chaos and neglect that characterized the Middle Eastern campaign. With senior leadership focused on Europe's killing fields, junior officers like Lawrence operated with remarkable autonomy, making decisions that would normally be reserved for generals and cabinet ministers. Lawrence wasn't alone in this shadow war of intelligence and influence. The story encompasses an American aristocrat secretly working for Standard Oil while advising the U.S. government, a German scholar fomenting Islamic Jihad against the colonial powers, and a Jewish scientist establishing an anti-Ottoman spy network crucial to creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine. These men, operating with minimal oversight, would collectively determine the fate of the post-Ottoman Middle East. What makes Lawrence's story particularly compelling is his moral evolution. Unlike his contemporaries who served their nation's interests without question, Lawrence grew increasingly tormented by his role in promising Arab independence while knowing his government planned to betray those promises. This burden of conscience would haunt him for the rest of his life, transforming him from an ambitious young officer to a man desperate to escape his own legend. Long before becoming Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence was an unusual child born into extraordinary circumstances. His father, Thomas Chapman, was an Anglo-Irish baronet who abandoned his aristocratic life and legitimate family to elope with his daughter's governess, Sarah Junner. Living under the assumed name Lawrence to escape scandal, the couple raised five sons in a household marked by rigid discipline, emotional distance, and constant fear of their secret being discovered. Young Ned Lawrence developed into a peculiar boy, intellectually brilliant but socially awkward, physically small but possessed of remarkable endurance. From early adolescence, he displayed an almost pathological ability to withstand pain and discomfort, deliberately testing his physical limits through long bicycle journeys and self-imposed deprivation. His mother's harsh religious discipline, which often included physical punishment, seemed to reinforce this stoicism. Lawrence made a point of never showing emotion during these whippings, which often made them worse. Lawrence's intellectual development took him to Jesus College, Oxford, where he studied medieval history and developed a passionate interest in Crusader castles. This academic focus led him to the Middle East for the first time in 1909, where he embarked on a 1,000-mile walking tour of Syria to study castle architecture. Local Arabs were astonished by this thin Englishman who traveled alone on foot through difficult terrain, refusing guides and enduring hardships that would challenge even experienced desert travelers. This journey transformed Lawrence. He discovered a deep affinity for Arab culture and developed fluency in Arabic, unusual skills that brought him to the attention of British archaeological authorities. By 1911, he had secured a position at the Carchemish excavation in northern Syria, where he would spend 3 formative years before the war. There, Lawrence demonstrated remarkable leadership abilities, managing hundreds of local workers with a natural authority that belied his youth and small stature. More significantly, Lawrence developed genuine relationships with his Arab colleagues, particularly a young Syrian named Dahoum, who became his close companion. Unlike most Europeans who maintained strict separation from natives, Lawrence immersed himself in local culture, living simply and learning tribal customs. This immersion gave him unique insights into Arab society that would prove invaluable during the war years, allowing him to navigate complex tribal politics with an understanding few Westerners possessed. When war erupted in 1914, Lawrence's intimate knowledge of the region made him invaluable to British intelligence. Initially assigned to the geographical section of the General Staff in London, he was soon transferred to Cairo, where his expertise in Syrian geography and Arab culture positioned him perfectly to influence Britain's emerging alliance with Arab rebels against their Ottoman overlords. The Ottoman Empire's decision to join the Central Powers in November 1914 transformed the Middle East into a crucial battleground. For centuries, European powers had competed for influence in the region through diplomacy and economic penetration. Now, with the Ottoman sick man of Europe finally collapsing, Britain, France, and Russia saw an opportunity to carve up these territories according to their imperial ambitions. Britain's position was particularly complex. As rulers of India, with its millions of Muslim subjects, British officials worried about the Ottoman Sultan's call for global jihad against the Allies. Simultaneously, they needed to protect the Suez Canal, their vital link to eastern colonies. These concerns led to contradictory policies and competing power centers within the British administration, the India Office, the Foreign Office, the Arab Bureau in Cairo, and various military commands all pursued different agendas. Into this confusion stepped Mark Sykes, a charismatic aristocrat and member of parliament who became Britain's chief Middle East strategist despite having no diplomatic experience. Sykes epitomized the amateur tradition in British imperial service, wealthy, well-connected men whose breeding and education supposedly qualified them for any task. Lawrence described him as a bundle of prejudices, intuitions, half-sciences, noting how Sykes constantly contradicted himself, impressed by whoever he'd last spoken with. In May 1916, Sykes negotiated a secret agreement with French diplomat François-Georges Picot, dividing Ottoman territories between their nations. Under this Sykes-Picot agreement, France would control Greater Syria, including Lebanon, while Britain would take Iraq. Palestine would fall under international administration, and only the desert interior would gain nominal Arab independence. The problem? Britain had simultaneously been negotiating with Hussein ibn Ali, the Sharif of Mecca, promising support for Arab independence in exchange for rebellion against the Ottomans. Through the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, British High Commissioner Henry McMahon had made commitments that directly contradicted what Sykes was promising the French. This double dealing created the central moral dilemma of Lawrence's war experience. Meanwhile, other powers pursued their own agendas. German intelligence officer Kurt Prüfer worked to incite anti-British sentiment among Muslims, while American oil companies maneuvered for future petroleum concessions. Zionist leaders lobbied for British support of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, culminating in the 1917 Balfour Declaration that promised the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. These competing promises and secret agreements created an impossible tangle of contradictions. Lawrence, positioned between British imperial interests and his Arab allies, grew increasingly aware that he was participating in a massive deception. The Arabs were fighting and dying for independence they would never receive, while European powers prepared to replace Ottoman rule with their own colonial administration.
When Lawrence arrived in Arabia in October 1916, the Arab revolt was floundering. Hussein ibn Ali had declared rebellion against Ottoman rule in June, but his forces lacked organization, equipment, and strategic direction. His sons, Ali, Abdullah, Faisal, and Zayd, led different segments of the revolt with varying degrees of competence. Lawrence immediately recognized Faisal as the most capable leader among Hussein's sons. Unlike the indolent Abdullah or the cautious Ali, Faisal combined military acumen with political vision. Lawrence attached himself to Faisal's camp, gradually transforming from observer to advisor to de facto commander of Arab military operations. The conventional British military approach had focused on using Arab forces as auxiliaries in set-piece battles, with predictably poor results against trained Turkish troops. Lawrence developed a radically different strategy based on his understanding of Arab strengths and Turkish weaknesses. Rather than attacking Ottoman strong points, he advocated mobile guerrilla warfare targeting the vulnerable Hejaz railway that supplied Turkish garrisons. The Arabs should not try to maintain or improve their position against the Turks, but attack the railway all the time, which is the most profitable way of fighting, Lawrence wrote in early 1917. This approach played to Bedouin strengths, mobility, desert knowledge, and raiding traditions, while avoiding direct confrontation with superior Turkish firepower. Lawrence's most audacious operation came in July 1917 with the capture of Aqaba. Rather than attacking this fortified port from the sea as the Turks expected, Lawrence led a small force on an epic 600-mile journey through the untraversable Nefud Desert, approaching Aqaba from the undefended landward side. This brilliant maneuver secured a vital supply port for the Arab forces with minimal casualties. The Aqaba victory transformed Lawrence's status. General Edmund Allenby, the new British commander in Palestine, recognized Lawrence's value and incorporated Arab operations into his broader strategy. Lawrence was promoted to major and given substantial resources to expand his campaign. As the war progressed, Lawrence's guerrilla operations grew increasingly sophisticated. He became an expert in demolitions, personally blowing up numerous trains and bridges. His raids tied down thousands of Turkish troops who might otherwise have reinforced the Palestine front against Allenby's conventional forces. By 1918, Lawrence commanded a mobile force that could strike anywhere along hundreds of miles of railway, creating what he called a war of detachment, where range is more than force. Yet the human cost of this campaign weighed heavily on Lawrence. He witnessed atrocities on both sides and participated in killings that haunted him. After the Turkish massacre of villagers at Tafas in September 1918, Lawrence ordered no quarter for enemy soldiers, resulting in the slaughter of hundreds of retreating Turks. "We killed and killed," he wrote, "even blowing in the heads of the fallen and of the animals." Most traumatizing was Lawrence's experience at Dera in November 1917, where he claimed to have been captured, beaten, and sexually assaulted by Ottoman soldiers. Though historians debate details of this incident, it clearly marked a psychological turning point. Lawrence became increasingly reckless in combat, as if seeking punishment or death, while his writings reflect growing disillusionment with the entire imperial project. While Lawrence conducted his desert campaign, an intricate intelligence war unfolded across the Middle East. The region became a playground for spies, double agents, and intelligence networks that shaped military operations and political outcomes. One of the most effective spy rings was Neeli, a Jewish intelligence network operating in Ottoman Palestine. Founded by agronomist Aaron Aronson and his sister Sarah, Neeli, an acronym from a Hebrew phrase meaning "the Eternal One of Israel will not lie," provided crucial intelligence to British forces. Aronson, an internationally respected scientist who had discovered wild wheat in Palestine, used his agricultural research station at Athlit as cover for extensive espionage activities.
The Nili network meticulously documented Turkish troop movements, fortifications, and supply depots. Sarah Aronson, operating as the network's coordinator after her brother traveled to Egypt, showed remarkable courage in maintaining operations despite growing Turkish suspicions. When Turkish authorities finally discovered the network in October 1917, Sarah endured brutal torture rather than reveal her collaborators. After 4 days of interrogation, she managed to shoot herself with a hidden pistol rather than risk breaking under further torture. On the German-Ottoman side, Kurt Prüfer emerged as a master spy. This German academic-turned-intelligence officer spoke fluent Arabic and had deep connections throughout the region. Operating from Damascus, Prüfer recruited Arab informants, organized sabotage operations against British interests, and worked to incite religious sentiment against the Allies. His most ambitious scheme involved recruiting Russian Jewish emigres in Palestine as spies, exploiting their anti-Tsarist sentiments to turn them against Russia's British allies. On the German-Ottoman side, Kurt Prüfer emerged as a master spy. This German academic-turned-intelligence officer spoke fluent Arabic and had deep connections throughout the region. Operating from Damascus, Prüfer recruited Arab informants, organized sabotage operations against British interests, and worked to incite religious sentiment against the Allies. His most ambitious scheme involved recruiting Russian Jewish emigres in Palestine as spies, exploiting their anti-Tsarist sentiments to turn them against Russia's British allies. American intelligence entered the game late through William Yale, a former Standard Oil employee recruited as a special agent for the State Department in 1917. Yale occupied an ambiguous position, officially representing American interests while remaining on Standard Oil's payroll and pursuing petroleum concessions. His reports to Washington provided valuable insights into Allied intentions, though the Wilson administration largely ignored his warnings about the consequences of European imperial designs for the region. The intelligence war featured remarkable episodes of deception. British naval intelligence created an elaborate ruse suggesting they planned to attack Alexandretta, diverting Turkish forces while Allenby prepared his actual offensive in Palestine. Lawrence deliberately leaked false information about Arab movements to confuse Turkish commanders. The Ottoman authorities, meanwhile, attempted to turn Arab tribes against each other through bribes and misinformation. Perhaps the most consequential intelligence operation came from an unexpected source, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. When Vladimir Lenin's government published secret Allied agreements in November 1917, including the full text of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, it confirmed Arab suspicions about British and French intentions. Lawrence had already revealed portions of this agreement to Faisal, but the public exposure created a crisis of confidence that threatened the entire Arab alliance. By September 1918, the Ottoman Empire was collapsing on all fronts. Bulgaria's surrender had cut Turkey's supply lines to Germany, while Allenby's forces had broken through in Palestine and were advancing rapidly northward. The race for Damascus, Syria's ancient capital, became the final act of the Desert War and the beginning of post-war political maneuvering. Lawrence understood that whoever controlled Damascus would shape Syria's future. If Arab forces could capture the city before British or French troops arrived, it would strengthen their claim to independence. With Allenby's approval, Lawrence led a lightning advance toward Damascus, while the main British army pursued retreating Turkish forces along the coast. The final approach to Damascus revealed the war's brutal nature. At Tafas, Lawrence and his men discovered the aftermath of Turkish atrocities against villagers. What followed was a merciless pursuit of the retreating Turkish column, with Arab forces killing even those who surrendered. Lawrence later described this as a madness that possessed them all, writing, "The best of them were very cruel tonight." On October 1, 1918, Arab forces entered Damascus ahead of British troops. Lawrence quickly established a provisional Arab government under Faisal's authority, outmaneuvering both French representatives and rival Arab factions. For a brief moment, it seemed the dream of Arab independence might be realized. reality intruded quickly. At a meeting in Damascus's Victoria Hotel on October 3, General Allenby informed Faisal that, despite previous understandings, Syria would become a French protectorate, with Faisal administering only the interior. The entire Mediterranean coastline would be part of Lebanon, making Syria landlocked. This announcement confirmed Lawrence's worst fears. The promises he had made to his Arab comrades would be broken. Exhausted physically and morally, Lawrence requested immediate leave. He departed Damascus the following day, never to return to the region that had defined his life for the past 2 years. His war was over, but the political battle for the Middle East's future was just beginning. The Ottoman Empire formally surrendered on October 30, 1918. With the war's end, the imperial powers moved to implement their secret agreements. The 1919 Paris Peace Conference became the arena where the modern Middle East would be shaped, with devastating consequences that continue to reverberate today.
The Paris Peace Conference of 1919 represented the final betrayal of Lawrence's promises to his Arab allies. Despite President Woodrow Wilson's rhetoric about self-determination for all peoples, the conference quickly devolved into an imperial carve-up of former Ottoman territories under the thin disguise of mandates, supposedly temporary administrations to prepare local populations for eventual independence. Lawrence arrived in Paris as part of the British delegation, but soon found himself marginalized. His advocacy for Arab independence contradicted official British policy, which now prioritized accommodating French demands and securing oil-rich Mesopotamia. Though briefly celebrated as a war hero through Lowell Thomas's popular lecture series with Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia, Lawrence was increasingly viewed as a troublesome idealist by British officials. Working as Faisal's advisor, Lawrence attempted various strategies to salvage something from the wreckage of Arab hopes. He arranged a meeting between Faisal and Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann, resulting in the short-lived Faisal-Weizmann Agreement that tentatively accepted Jewish settlement in Palestine in exchange for Zionist support of Arab independence elsewhere. Lawrence also leaked information to the American delegation, hoping to engage Wilson's idealism against European imperialism. These efforts proved futile. On December 1, 1918, British Prime Minister David Lloyd George and French Premier Georges Clemenceau had already decided the region's fate in a 5-minute conversation. Britain would take Iraq and Palestine, France would have Syria and Lebanon. This arrangement, essentially affirming the Sykes-Picot Agreement, would be implemented regardless of local wishes. When the American King Crane Commission actually investigated Arab preferences, finding overwhelming support for independence or American administration rather than European control, their report was simply shelved. William Yale, serving on this commission, resigned in disgust when it became clear the findings would be ignored. The conference's decisions were formalized in the 1920 Treaty of Sèvres and the San Remo Conference, which established British mandates over Palestine and Iraq and French control of Syria and Lebanon. These arbitrary boundaries, drawn with little regard for ethnic, religious, or historical realities, created the problematic borders that continue to define Middle Eastern conflicts today. Lawrence left Paris deeply disillusioned. "The old men came to the peace conference," he later wrote, "and made their peace from pieces of paper, without seeing what they did." He suffered what his mother described as extreme depression and nervous exhaustion, sometimes sitting motionless for hours. The betrayal of his promises to the Arabs would haunt him for the rest of his life. The settlement imposed at Paris quickly unraveled. In March 1920, Faisal was proclaimed King of Syria by a local congress, only to be forcibly removed by French troops 4 months later. Arab resistance to European mandates erupted across the region, most dramatically in Iraq, where a massive rebellion in 1920 cost thousands of lives before being brutally suppressed. Facing this chaos, the British government turned to Winston Churchill as colonial secretary in 1921. Churchill immediately enlisted Lawrence's help, and together they reshaped Britain's Middle Eastern policy at the Cairo Conference.
Their pragmatic solutions included installing Faisal as king of Iraq and creating Transjordan, modern Jordan, as a separate territory under Faisal's brother Abdullah. These arrangements provided some stability but left fundamental problems unresolved. In Palestine, increasing Jewish immigration following the Balfour Declaration created growing tensions with the Arab population. Iraq's artificial boundaries lumped together Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites with little common identity. Syria remained restive under French rule. Lawrence himself retreated from public life after briefly serving under Churchill. In 1922, he enlisted in the Royal Air Force as an ordinary airman under the pseudonym John Hume Ross, later changing his name legally to T.E. Shaw. This extraordinary step, a famous war hero choosing to serve as a common soldier, reflected his desire to escape both his celebrity and his guilt over the Arab betrayal. Though Lawrence published his war memoir, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, in 1926, initially in a limited edition of 200 copies, he refused commercial exploitation of his story and donated all royalties from the abridged version, Revolt in the Desert. He lived simply in a small cottage called Clouds Hill in Dorset, maintaining correspondence with literary figures like Thomas Hardy and E.M. Forster, but avoiding public appearances. On May 19, 1935, Lawrence died from injuries sustained in a motorcycle accident near his cottage. Winston Churchill, attending his funeral, eulogized him as one of the greatest beings alive in our time, adding, "I fear, whatever our need, we shall never see his like again." The other key players in this drama met varied fates. Aaron Aronson died in a 1919 plane crash while traveling to Paris. Mark Sykes succumbed to Spanish influenza during the peace conference. Kurt Prufer later joined the Nazi Party and served as ambassador to Brazil during World War II. William Yale eventually became a history professor at the University of New Hampshire after failing to regain employment with Standard Oil. The consequences of their actions continue to shape the Middle East. The artificial borders they created remained largely intact, cutting across ethnic and sectarian communities. The competing promises made to Arabs and Jews evolved into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The authoritarian regimes that eventually replaced European mandates often justified their repression as necessary resistance to Western imperialism. Perhaps most significantly, the betrayal of Arab aspirations for independence created lasting distrust of Western intentions throughout the region. As Lawrence himself predicted, the settlement imposed after World War I left a legacy of resentment that would fuel conflicts for generations to come. T.E. Lawrence remains an enigmatic figure whose brief moment on the world stage continues to fascinate us. His extraordinary journey from obscure archaeologist to battlefield commander to disillusioned veteran embodies the moral complexities of imperial power and its human consequences. What distinguishes Lawrence from his contemporaries was his capacity for self-awareness and moral growth. Unlike Sykes or Prufer, who largely accepted their nation's imperial projects without question, Lawrence developed a critical consciousness about his role in promising Arabs freedom while knowing these promises would be broken. "I had told the Arabs that England kept her word," he wrote. "In this, I was a deliberate liar." This moral burden helps explain Lawrence's retreat from public life and his rejection of honors. When King George V attempted to knight him at Buckingham Palace in October 1918, Lawrence quietly refused the honor, creating an unprecedented moment of confusion before walking away under the Queen's furious gaze. He similarly declined the Victoria Cross and the Order of Merit. Lawrence's legacy extends beyond his personal story. His military innovations, particularly his development of guerrilla tactics against conventional forces, influenced generations of irregular warfare from Vietnam to Afghanistan. His cultural approach to counterinsurgency, emphasizing understanding local customs and working through indigenous leaders, remains relevant to modern military operations. His political insights about the Middle East have proven remarkably prescient. Lawrence warned that imposing European control over Arab lands would create a peace so artificial that it could not last a generation. He predicted that the Balfour Declaration's support for Jewish settlement in Palestine would require force of arms and maintained by force of arms amid an overwhelmingly hostile population. He foresaw that arbitrary boundaries drawn by European powers would create unstable states vulnerable to sectarian conflict. Perhaps most significantly, Lawrence's story reminds us that history is shaped not just by impersonal forces, but by individual moral choices. In the chaotic environment of wartime Middle East, a handful of men with limited oversight made decisions that created the region we know today. Their ambitions, prejudices, and occasional moments of conscience determined outcomes that affected millions of lives across generations. Lawrence himself understood this burden. "We pay for these things too much in honor and in innocent lives," he wrote about imperial conquests. His journey from enthusiastic participant to tortured critic of empire reflects a moral awakening that transcends his specific historical moment. In a world still grappling with the consequences of imperial ambition and arbitrary borders, Lawrence's struggle to reconcile duty with conscience remains powerfully relevant.